Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Turkey and Syria exchanging cross-border mortar shelling for a fifth day, with the Turkish Prime Minister saying the two countries are not far from war. Asli Bali, a professor in the UCLA School of Law who is on the Advisory Council of the Middle East Division of Human Rights Watch, joins us to discuss the escalation of war in the region. Then we'll get an assessment of the role of journalism in the presidential debates following the first exchange between Romney and Obama, where the big questions hovering over the campaign about Mitt Romney's taxes and his attitude towards the 47% were not discussed. The founder and director of the Project for Excellence in Journalism, Tom Rosensteel, joins us to discuss how the American people and our democracy are not being served by these staged and circumscribed events. Then finally, we will speak with Lynn Povich about how she and a group of the good girls at Newsweek, during the era of madmen and male chauvinism, revolted against being secretaries and researchers and sued their bosses and changed journalism. Lynn Povich is the author of the new book, The Good Girls Revolt, How the Women of Newsweek Sued Their Bosses and Changed the Workplace. And joining us now is Asli Bali, who's a professor at the UCLA School of Law, where she teaches courses on public international law, international human rights, and the laws of war. She is on the Advisory Council of the Middle East Division of Human Rights Watch. Welcome to Background Briefing, Asli Bali.
Thank you for having me.
And Turkish artillery have returned fire into Syria for a fifth day now, and where mortars from Syria landed on a border village, which was fortunately vacated. But last week in the town of Akakali, I guess it's pronounced, there was the death of five civilians, which included two women and three children. That really upset the Turkish Prime Minister and, I guess, by extension, the Turkish people.
That's right. There's been tremendous public consternation about what's happening at the Turkish border at this point. As you mentioned, the border town of Akçakale has unfortunately faced a tremendous amount of pressure as Tel Abyad on the Syrian side of the border, so the town on the Syrian side of the border that is currently the site of hot conflict between the rebel groups, various rebel groups which hold that town, and the Syrian government forces. As that fighting goes on, what appear to be errant mortars are crossing into Akçakale, and it's creating a situation, as you mentioned, five consecutive days now of Turkish reprisal action into Syria is the most, sort of instability and cross-border violence that we've seen since the beginning of events in Syria some 20 months ago.
So what is happening then? The New York Times on Sunday is carrying a front page story suggesting that the Saudis and the Qataris have wanted to arm the Syrian rebels with shoulder-fired missiles and more than just the AK-47 assault rifles, which just seem to be pretty much all they have. And these efforts have been vetoed by the United States. Apparently, the U.S. doesn't want the rebels armed more than they are. And then on September the 5th, the Prime Minister Erdogan of Turkey scolded Obama for his lack of policy and initiatives on Syria during an interview with CNN. So what is the attitude in Turkey about what the U.S. is doing? So if the U.S. is the one that's basically in charge here, given that they've basically been restraining Qatar and Saudi Arabia?
So first I would just say that I think there's lots of evidence that much heavier weapons have entered into Syria, including the fact that Syrian rebels have successfully fired on Syrian regime air forces and air power, and that there's every reason to think that there are, in fact, shoulder-fired missiles and so forth at the act. That the Syrian rebels have had access to and have exhibited a capacity to deploy in the last couple of months. I also think that it's overstated to claim that the Saudis and Qataris are somehow being radically held back. I think there are a number of things that are going on at the international level. From the perspective of the Syrian rebels, of course, they're very frustrated. They want much stronger support, including much more sophisticated weapons, but also a no-fly zone, and they also want a border region to be created that's a kind of buffer zone. I think what's happening right now at the border is potentially the nascent form of that border zone. I mean, Syrian rebels have basically engaged government forces in such a way that errant mortar, and basically to date, there hasn't been any clear definitive determination that that shelling or the mortar fire that's come in has in fact not been from the rebels themselves. I mean, the mortar fire that's falling into Turkey is coming from this border town, and it's impossible to know whether or not it's government forces or rebel forces that are responsible.
So what exactly did the Turkish Prime Minister say then on CNN, where he was complaining about the lack of policy and initiatives on the part of the United States vis-a-vis Syria?
So there has been a general idea that the United States is somehow, and this is something that's really held by the rebels on the ground as well, that the U.S. government is using the pretext, quote-unquote, of the Security Council's inaction to basically fail to engage more seriously in Syria. So the claim is that it's convenient that the Russians and the Chinese are opposed to more substantial engagement in Syria because that offers cover at a time that there's a U.S. presidential election underway to avoid making substantial decisions or commitments in Syria on the part of the United States. I think that that is a misreading in some ways and correct in other ways. It's correct in the following way. There's no clear course at the moment through which an intervention in Syria, whether it took the form of much heavier weaponry for the rebels or a no-fly zone or a buffer zone or various of the ideas that the Turkish Prime Minister and others have floated, would actually do more good than harm from the perspective of either A, bringing an end to the conflict, or B, alleviating the humanitarian suffering of the population on the ground. I think all of those courses of action are extremely dangerous for a variety of reasons that, you know, many have already detailed, including the location of Syria, the other countries in the region that may very well get drawn into a conflagration there, the potential to further escalate the actual violence, that you might end up in a place where you have a circumstance where both parties escalate the violence dramatically, but neither is able to establish a substantial enough gain on the other to actually prevail. And so you just have a much, much more violent civil conflict underway, that you have outside forces infiltrating that no party is really able to control, including potentially terrorist groups that are attracted to Syria from other parts of the world, and so forth. So there are all kinds of risks. And so I do think it's the case, I do think it's true, that there's no appetite for intervening in Syria on the part of the United States or other Western powers, even France, which has taken a more aggressive posture, independent of whether or not Russia and China exercise a veto on the Security Council. There is a desire to be much more, to censure Syria, to place much more pressure on Iran with respect to its relationship to Syria. But in terms of direct willingness to commit either materiel or forces on the ground, I think that there is real reluctance to do that for fear of getting drawn into another conflict in the Middle East that has a very uncertain trajectory at this point, even with intervention from outside. So I think what the Turkish Prime Minister is reacting to or expressing frustration about is that fact, that notwithstanding the Russian and Chinese positions, actually there is no clear direction that the United States or others is willing at this point to endorse. And Turkey would like to see a dramatically stepped up commitment on the part of its NATO allies to engage in much more forceful intervention. I think that that's a very sort of blinkered view that the Turkish Prime Minister has adopted, which has much more to do with goals that Turkey has in the region and in Syria than it has to do with the benefits that might flow from that posture to Syrian civilians or just to the capacity to terminate the Syrian conflict. And as a result, and I should say, by the way, that opposition within Turkey to the Prime Minister's position is also consolidating. I mean, there is a tremendous distress in Turkey amongst the Turkish public about what is perceived as the bellicosity of the prime minister. And it's becoming a source of increasing division and friction within Turkey. This is one place where he has taken a very clear position, at least domestically in the political spectrum, and has actually lost support even from among his own supporters, in part because people fear getting pulled into a war with Syria, in part also because people fear what the implications of this bellicose posture are for domestic Turkish considerations, including the relationship with the Kurdish community in the southeast, including the relationship with the IDV community within Turkey. So people are quite uncomfortable, and there have been notable pro-peace, anti-intervention protests and demonstrations in Turkey over the course of the last 5 days.
Again, I'm speaking with Asli Bal, who's a professor at the UCLA School of Law, where she teaches courses on public international law, international human rights, and the laws of war. She's on the Advisory Council of the Middle East Division of Human Rights Watch. Now, my understanding is that Turkey believes that Syria's Kurds, you mentioned the Kurds, Turkey believes that Syria's Kurds are assisting the PKK, that's the Kurdistan Workers' Party, who have been intensifying their campaign against the Turkish military since the Syrian crisis began. They also believe that the Assad regime is assisting the Syrian Kurds in assisting the PKK. So what is going on there? Is Assad stirring the pot there?
Yes. So Assad has indicated that if Turkey carries on, and again, one has to step back and remember that Turkey has for the last, you know, over 18 months now, allowed the Free Syrian Army and the Syrian National Council and other opposition groups to operate from within Turkey, establish headquarters in Turkey, establish media bureaus in Turkey, you know, run their PR campaign out of Turkey and so forth. So Turkey has taken a very clear position in support of the opposition forces and has called for Bashar al-Assad to step down and so forth. So the posture between the two countries has been one in which Turkey is offering support to rebel groups that are engaged in direct hostilities of the Syrian government. The Syrian government's response has been to say, we have no reason to restrain Kurdish groups, either A, from taking shelter in our territory after engaging in attacks against Turkish forces within Turkey, or B, organizing in whatever way they would like, across between the Turkish Kurdish community and the Syrian Kurdish community, if they wish to coordinate, if they wish to engage in joint action and so forth. We no longer have any reason as a regime to interfere with their activities. And so we will give them free rein. And this is basically our response to you, Turkey, or you, Prime Minister Erdogan, your willingness to house forces that have taken up arms against our regime. We no longer see any reason why we should prevent forces that have taken up arms against your regime from operating in our territory. So it's really a tit-for-tat position. And, of course, it has had a very significant impact in Turkey. Now, having said that, it would be a mistake, I think, to frame this as the Kurdish rebel groups in Turkey have stepped up their violence since the hostilities began in Syria. I think actually the more appropriate thing to say is that the Turkish government returned basically in 2010 to direct repression of the Kurdish community and punitive measures against elected civilian leaders in the Turkish Kurdish community. And as a result, we have seen an increase in sort of support for rebel factions and a kind of sense of futility among Kurdish communities of the sort of investment in peaceful civilian politics because of the incredible repression that they've faced from the Turkish government, which is completely independent of and predates events in Syria.
Well, just in closing, Asli Bali, this situation, I think, is destined to get worse, is it not, given that we've been discussing the lack of policy or the extent to which the election considerations here in the United States perhaps restraining the president from any real action, and any real action itself is fraught with problems. So I get the impression that nobody quite knows how to get out of this situation. Is that right?
Well, so again, I should say that it's the Turkish prime minister and others that are claiming that it's the U.S. presidential election that is leading to no real action. My own position is that it's the absence of a clear course to take. The only course, a clear course involving greater intervention in the conflict that would somehow yield any benefit. I think that there's almost no case to be made that you can engage short of a full air campaign and then ground invasion of Syria, which would then, of course, alter dramatically the calculation that's on the table right now, not necessarily for the better, but it would be very difficult to calculate at this moment what the consequences of some incredible commitment of force a la Iraq would look like in Syria. I think that would be a disastrous error. But short of that kind of a commitment, I don't think that one can establish at all that there's a way militarily to end this conflict. I think that means there is a course, and I think it's a course that hasn't been invested in adequately at all by the United States or, for that matter, by the Turkish government or others. And that course is, if you can't end this conflict militarily, if there's no clear way, in the short term at least, to bring to an end the fighting that has endangered the civilian population militarily, then the way to go is to try to structure a negotiated outcome in Syria. And here you had the Egyptian Prime Minister Morsi step forward and engage in, the Egyptian President Morsi step forward and engage in an initiative that I thought was extremely promising, in which, crucially, he brought the Egyptians, the Turks, the Saudis, and the Iranians within a single mediating framework in order to, and of course, all of the Syrian factions. The idea was to have a negotiation in which you had the supporters of both sides also at the table. Now, Saudi Arabia balked at this. It's not at all clear if it's sustainable, but that would be a much more productive direction, in my view, for the U.S. or others to invest, which is to say, and that the principles within the country, but more importantly, their external supporters, come to a negotiation together so that it actually involves a compromise involving all of the parties that at this point are stakeholders in this conflict. And unfortunately, because there is such a strong regional presence of stakeholders, including the ones you've named, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and Turkey, as supporters of the opposition, who continually basically send the message to opposition forces on the ground that they should not and need not compromise with the regime because time is on their side, they will eventually prevail because they have tremendous outside support and the Syrian regime has few friends. But they have friends. The Syrian regime on its side has Iran regionally and Russia internationally supporting it. And if you can't bring the Russians and the Iranians to a table around a negotiation, then the reality is you're not engaging in meaningful negotiation. You're simply speaking to your own counterparts among your allies or those who have taken a similar position on Syria, and that is not a productive way to negotiate and enter the conflict. If, by contrast, you were to engage, and engaging means not only bringing to the table, but actually being prepared to make concessions, including regional concessions. For example, obviously, Iran's currency has now lost 40% of its value almost overnight. It's under tremendous economic strain and so forth. The parties that have imposed sanctions on Iran are the same parties that support the Syrian rebels. And there's plenty of room for a coordinated negotiation where all parties could get something that they're seeking regionally in exchange for bringing real pressure to bear, both on the Syrian regime and on armed rebel groups, to desist from the fighting. And I think that's the only course available at this point that even has a hope of securing an end to the hostilities that we're seeing. And again, what we haven't discussed, but what is crucial, is to bear in mind that 20,000 to 30,000 Syrian civilians have been killed, and some 250,000 to 400,000 have left the country, with tens of thousands more internally displaced at this point. I mean, the price is being paid for this conflict is being paid in the blood of Syrian civilians. And unfortunately, all of this kind of regional posturing around the situation in Syria does not, any of it, correspond to individual actors, whether it's Turkey or the United States or Saudi Arabia or Iran, that have the welfare of Syrian civilians first and foremost in their policy priorities.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Asli Bali.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Asli Bali, who's a professor at the UCLA School of Law, where she teaches courses on public international law, international human rights, and the laws of war. She is on the Advisory Council of the Middle East Division of Human Rights Watch. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with the founder and director of the Project for Excellence in Journalism about the role of journalism in the presidential debates.
Idiot wind blowing in through the front door. Idiot wind blowing in from the back. Idiot wind blowing in from every crevice, every crack. Anybody wanna tell it like it is to each other? Like you would to a sister or a brother. It could be said, cosmopolitan style.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Tom Rosensteel, who's the founder and director of the Project for Excellence in Journalism. He's been a journalist for more than three decades, including as a media critic for the Los Angeles Times and as chief congressional correspondent for Newsweek magazine. He's also the co-founder of the Committee of Concerned Journalists, and he and his colleague Bill Kovach have co-written the books Warp Speed, America in the Age of Mixed Media, and The Elements of Journalism, What News People Should Know and the Public Should Expect. Their new book is Blur, How to Know What's True in the Age of Information Overload. Welcome to Background Briefing, Tom Rosensteel.
Thank you, Ian. Good to be back.
And in terms of information overload, from the first presidential debate, it seemed to me that there wasn't really much information in there for the American people about these two candidates. It seemed more to do with posturing than substance. I mean, some of the biggest questions that face humanity, for example, like global warming, none of those appeared. The first debate itself was in Colorado, quite near the shooting that took place a while back, where a lot of people were massacred in a cinema. No mention of gun control. What was your sense of how well the American people were served by the first debate?
Well, there's always this tension between trying to create an exchange that is open and not so structured that the candidates that we don't see the candidates themselves, that they just sort of are engaged in following the formula of a structured encounter, and having something free-flowing enough that the candidates then can kind of filibuster and control it. So I think we saw that tension in this first debate. It was supposed to be about domestic affairs. There were time limits and segments, but the moderator, Jim Lehrer, didn't want to be too insistent about disciplining the candidates. And as a consequence, I think they, by and large, got to control the format, and that also meant controlling the issues, talking about the things they wanted to talk about. And while it was a very wonky debate in one sense, and some people even argue it was dull because it got very much in the weeds, it also was a recitation of fairly familiar subject matter or talking points that people who've been paying attention to the campaign had heard before. Not much that was new that was introduced other than sort of anecdotes about people that the candidates had met along the way and things like that. But the substance of what they were talking about were things that we've heard before.
So what do you think, though, Tom Rosensteel, is the logic of having these debates controlled by the parties, that the Republicans and the Democrats? It used to be that the League of Women Voters ran it, and they set the rules. And by setting the rules, it seems that the two parties go for blandness and safeness. In other words, why not have Keith Olbermann and Rush Limbaugh as your questioners? I mean, to my mind, the big questions that I'm sure conservatives have about Obama, God knows, it could be whether or not he has a birth certificate. But on the liberal side that I'm more familiar with, there's certainly a lot of questions about Romney's 47% speech that he made to the fundraiser at the fundraiser, and also why he hasn't revealed his taxes. None of that came up. So I'm just again wondering when they'll talk about something that actually interests the voters.
Yeah, well, the era of the League of Women Voters is a kind of elevated protector of the Democratic process, being in charge of the debates, that's gone. The presidential debates, the two candidates are not fully in charge. There's the Presidential Debate Commission, and the Debate Commission, which has got a Republican and a Democratic chair, Mike McCurry is the Democratic chair, the former Clinton press secretary. They technically control what's going to happen, but these people know what the parties will put up with. There's sort of a kabuki dance of what they think is acceptable and what they think the parties will, you know, they'll push as hard as they can to what the candidates would allow. But we've advanced a little bit, at least, from where we were a few cycles ago, where a candidate could actually just nix a format or nix a moderator. But it does leave us in this place where there's a risk aversion. This is very establishment, and the idea of Olbermann and Limbaugh moderating a debate, which might you know, be very interesting for at least one debate, that's not within the realm of likelihood or probably even possibility. I think for me, the question of what's a perfect debate format, the answer is that there isn't one, and that the most valuable thing we can see is different formats across each debate, because that increases the likelihood that you're going to see some different facet of the candidates. One thing to remember is that these are the only encounters in this whole 2 to 3 year process in which you see these two contenders on stage together in a comparative format. So whatever in the end are the rules of a particular debate or who the moderator is actually pales in comparison to the significance that you only are going to see these guys together on the same stage relative to each other 3 times. And whatever formula they pick for each debate is going to be strategized and picked apart, and, you know, they'll have their talking points. The idea that you can create something that is entirely spontaneous is not going to happen. So create enough differences here for each format that we might see something legitimate or authentic.
Again, I'm speaking with Tom Rosenstiel, the founder and director of the Project for Excellence in Journalism. He's the author of Blur, How to Know What's True in the Age of Information Overload. Well, why not have more of them then? I mean, I thought that we got a lot more out of the Republican primary debates. There were a whole bunch of them, and of course they were only too eager to have those debates, so the networks that hosted them were able to put their journalists on the job and ask, I think, more probing questions. Three, that's it? That's all the public get? For who gets to be the new leader of the free world?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question, Ian, because we had 21 primary debates, and that was just within the Republican Party. There were lots of different formats, and the sponsors were usually a TV channel such as CNN or Fox, and usually a partner. They actually got pretty good ratings. Some of them were exceeded 3-4 million viewers for a one-party cable debate, which is, by that standard, pretty big numbers. The reason that there were so many is you had a lot of people in those debates who actually had no aspiration to really become their party nominee. Even the debate organizers realized that some of these candidates, like Herman Cain and some others, were running to raise their profile. I've heard some even party people say that they're running to get elected to have their own talk show, but not actually to be the party nominee. So they had much to gain from the exposure of those debates and very little to lose. Once you are the party nominee, you have much to lose in a debate. And so the candidates would not be willing to expose themselves to the inevitable ravages of being out there so many times. It might be very good for the voters, but the President of the United States is not going to take that risk. nor probably would even the challenger, unless he or she was such a skilled debater that they thought they would come out on top of this. It would be like playing best of seven Super Bowl. You know, your players would barely be able to walk afterwards. So it actually is an interesting prospect, but because of the stakes and the motivations that explain primary debates versus general election debates, unless there was an independent organization that was stronger than the parties, it's not going to happen. And now, the candidates are actually stronger than their parties. Once you are the nominee of your party, you control the party, and you can become the nominee of your party, even if your party doesn't want you initially, which is what happened with Obama. So in the modern era, in the 21st century, candidates are stronger than any other entity, and I don't see them saying yes to that.
But Tom Rosenthal, you said that the candidates aren't prepared to take that risk. We, on the other hand, the American people, take a risk in voting for somebody that we don't really know about. Now, we did learn quite a bit about Mitt Romney, but it wasn't sure who the Mitt Romney was. There's an old, journalism 101 question in British politics where I think journalists are less deferential towards politicians than, say, they are on the NewsHour, where it's usually, I respectfully disagree with my learned colleague, and there's all this comedy between the congresspeople or the senators when they're going back and forth. The standard question in British politics is to the politician, Mr. Member of Parliament, on Thursday you said X, and today you said Y. Were you lying on Thursday, or are you lying today? That's a pretty standard question. I was wishing somebody could have pulled Mitt Romney over. Is that the job of Jim Lehrer, or is that the job of Barack Obama?
Well, in American politics, probably more the job of political advertising. That's where we see our mudslinging. I know that Jim Lehrer's attitude, and I think that of the debate commissions as well, is that if you're noticing the moderator, that's probably a problem. And the moderator will almost certainly come in for criticism. That if you had to err on one side or the other, erring on the side of the moderator being stepping out of the way and letting the candidates have at it, is probably the better default, you become an easy target if you're the moderator. If you start sparring, and it looks as if you're debating the candidate, there's another sort of inevitable and long-standing, ever-present tension in the way that press approaches campaigns, and that is, to what extent is it their campaigns to run, and if they want to run them badly, there's not much we can do. That's revealing by itself. And to what extent is the press supposed to be a mediator, refereeing, throwing flags, calling a lie, and the rest? And the answer is, both things are the role of the press on a spectrum, and you have to sort of know when to be aggressive and when to sit back. And there's an element of taste, an element of understanding where the audience is at in these things. And when you're live in a debate, it's extremely challenging. I recall Ted Koppel telling me once that on Nightline, when he hosted for many, many years, he would jump in on a question not when it first occurred to him that the interviewee was lying or stonewalling, but when he thought the audience had reached the point where they were thinking, Ted, get in there, he's stonewalling.
Well, I'm sure a lot of Obama partisans were saying that to the television set the other night. But so what then is the role of the moderator as a fact checker? Is that, I mean, I'm aware of this canard of the liberal press, and I'm speaking to you from a Pacifica station, which is about as liberal as it gets, and I know that we are not the most powerful voice in the media, anything but. Fox News is infinitely more powerful and pervasive. So there is this, I find it a bit of a hoax, the idea that we have a liberal media. But I think the effect of that canard has been to move the goalposts, and aren't a lot of people in the so-called liberal mainstream media very conscious of that charge, and therefore they may not want to step out and pull over the conservative candidate if he's being going over the top with his prevarications. Would that be a factor?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think that... you know, we're in a mixed media culture now, and there's plenty of sources out there who, besides the so-called MSM, the mainstream media, to some extent, this issue, I think, is going to resolve itself. The and you can watch a debate and have a Twitter feed up and see the event being fact-checked by a broad populace of activists and citizens. In a way that was not possible a few years ago. So, to some extent, I think we need our moderators to be moderate, our reporters to report, and there's no shortage now of analysts across the political spectrum.
Well, Tom Rosensteel, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Tom Rosensteel, who's the founder and director of the Projects for Excellence in Journalism. He has been a journalist for more than three decades, including as a media critic for the Los Angeles Times and as chief congressional correspondent for Newsweek magazine. He also co-founded the Committee of Concerned Journalists, and he and his colleague Bill Kovach have co-written the books Warp Speed, America in the Age of Mixed Media, and The Elements of Journalism, What News People Should Know and the Public Should Expect. Their new book is Blur, How to Know What's True in the Age of Information Overload. We're going to take a brief station break and back talking about how in the age of Mad Men, the good girls change journalism. Watching the horse as it follows the cart, I sweep off my broken spell, and I felt something change in the world, like a new constitution, a thief I would have to pursue, at all times, at all costs. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now in the studio is Lynn Povich, who began her career at Newsweek as a secretary, and in 1975 she became the first woman senior editor in the magazine's history. Since leaving Newsweek, she has been editor-in-chief of Working Woman magazine and managing editor, senior executive producer for MSNBC.com. She's the author of the new book, The Good Girls Revolt, How the Women of Newsweek Sued Their Bosses and Changed the Workplace. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lynn Povich.
Thank you, Ian.
So just before we begin, I'd like to, since you've obviously had a long career in journalism and to some extent the role of journalism is being questioned following the first presidential debate, in as much as a lot of people are piling on Jim Lehrer for not... asking tough questions and not controlling the event, but in a sense, these debates I don't think serve the American people. There's only three of them. They're so orchestrated and so controlled. The big issues, for example, that everybody's been thinking about, at least in terms of Mitt Romney, have been his taxes and his statements about the 47%. Well, that simply didn't appear. So What would your critique be as a journalist of what happened last night?
Well, I do think that the general consensus that Obama didn't perform as well as he should have. He didn't raise all of the issues he has in the past and has all this information. And that Romney seemed to me to control and have most of the time on the debate. Now, what he said and whether it was true is certainly being questioned. And I think Obama tried to make that remark. But I think everyone says that being a moderator for one of those debates is a thankless job. I do think that Jim Lehrer certainly didn't control it and wasn't specific enough in his kinds of questions. And I think that's unfortunate.
So how did it strike you, though, that where a candidate running for president of the United States says to the moderator, essentially, I'm going to put you out of business. I'm going to defund PBS.
I was amazed that he said that, and I'm amazed that people haven't been talking about that ever since. I know they talk about performance, but I haven't seen that specifically raised. I think that's pretty shocking, and I think for those of us who care and are loyal listeners and supporters of any kind of public television or radio, you know, this certainly will define his position of how he feels about communities and serving communities.
So tell me then about, let's go back to your story in the new book, The Good Girl Revolt, How the Women of Newsweek Sued Their Bosses and Changed the Workplace. You started out, and of course there are obvious comparisons to Mad Men in the sense that that seems to be the environment that out of which you began. But then, of course, the period that we're talking about also was the period of great change from the button-down Eisenhower years to the swinging 60s. So tell us about when you first got to Newsweek and how you as a woman and your colleagues were treated.
Well, we were the generation who were post-war generation who were raised in the 40s and 50s. And the expectation for most women then was that you might get a job and then you would get married and have children. The idea of a career never crossed my parents' lips, and I went to a women's college. No professor ever suggested that I prepare for a career. So actually, at the time, getting hired at Newsweek was a very glamorous job because it was a newsroom. It was fascinating. We worked with the writers and the reporters. The problem was that the structure of Newsweek, which simply copied the structure from Time, was that only men were hired as reporters and writers, and only women were hired as fact-checkers or researchers. Actually, we started on the mail desk and then clipped newspapers, and then if we could do that, we got to be researchers. So while the system was collegial and fun and exciting, it was patriarchal. It was definitely run by the guys. And we were a class of women who could not get promoted out of this category.
And what was the, just in terms of the office atmosphere, because obviously you can't get Mad Men out of your picture,
you know,
of the Don Drapers and I've seen and of course the pictures in your book of these guys with their pipes and stuff.
Yes,
it says a lot about that era.
Well, I always say, of course, the advertising guys were much better dressed than the journalists, and we didn't have martini trays in our office. And most of the guys kept the biscotch and bourbon in the bottom drawer. But yes, it was the 60s. It was an office wife sort of. We were the handmaidens to the writers. And there was a lot of sex in the office. Most of it, I have to say, was consensual. It was definitely the 60s, and we were pretty young. There were, however, instances where there was sexual harassment and people crossed the line, and there was a lot of behavior that would have been considered illegal today.
Well, it was considered illegal then, though, when you brought your lawsuit. It was, 4 years after the Civil Rights Act?
Right. The Civil Rights Act was 64, and we started organizing in 69 and brought the suit in 70. But Mad Men, remember, on television is the earlier 60s. So it's actually before the Civil Rights Act. And it was when, if you were a reporter, a woman who wanted to write and you came to Newsweek as your first job, they legally said to you, women don't write here. If you want to write, go someplace else.
Again, I'm speaking with Lynn Povich, who began her career at Newsweek as a secretary, and in 1975 she became the first woman senior editor in the magazine's history. And since leaving Newsweek, she has been editor-in-chief of Working Women magazine and the managing editor, senior executive producer for MSNBC.com. She's the author of the new book, The Good Girls Revolt, How the Women of Newsweek Sued Their Bosses and Changed the Workplace. And the women involved, along with yourself, are Ellen Goodman, Jane Bryant Quinn, Nora Ephron, Susan Brown Miller, some stellar names.
Well, what's interesting about those very successful women is they were hired at Newsweek after college in the early 60s. And when they realized that they weren't going to become writers, they actually left. They were the smart ones. We good girls stayed. So by 1970, they had gone. They were not part of our suit, but they had been there and seen the lay of the land and left.
But you had a trial run which went nowhere, and then things seems to work when you hired Eleanor Holmes Norton, who was the Human Rights Commissioner in New York, as your attorney.
At the time, Eleanor was the assistant legal director of the ACLU, and when we organized and realized we needed a lawyer to represent us and figure out exactly what we should do, we went to Eleanor, and she grabbed the magazine out of our hands and looked at the masthead and said, "The fact that there are men from the very top category to the next to the last category, and there are only women in the bottom category, means that there's a pattern, and I will take your case."
And now, of course, she is the U.S. representative in the House of Representatives for the District of Columbia,
yes,
albeit
the non-voting member, yes, of
exactly.
The House.
And if the Republicans have their way, she will continue to be the non-voting member, even though she does represent a congressional constituency. So what do you think, then, is the is the legacy here of what you've done? Because a lot of women who fought the good fight, people like Gloria Steinem, when they're dealing with younger women, there is this sort of historical amnesia about how women got to where they are today, It's that old adage about unions. Yeah, well, you may not like unions, but they're the people who brought you the weekend. So, in a sense, you may like feminists, but they're the people who brought you the rights that you have.
Yes. Yes, I met some young women at Newsweek in 2010 who didn't know anything about our suit and discovered it and then started calling us, and we met together. And they became very interested. Two of them did not want to be called feminists at the time, and since discovering the suit, meeting us, and talking about our history, which was very relevant to them, they were feeling some of the same things 40 years later that we had been, which was that they were being marginalized and they couldn't understand why young women were getting ahead faster. So by discovering the history, and I was a history major, so this makes me very happy, they actually became very interested in women's issues. They now call themselves feminists, and it has sort of reawakened this concern. Of course, the political season has helped with the realization that what we took for granted as rights that we had won are now being threatened. But yes, I think that the young women had been turned off by feminism, mostly by the style of either what they thought it was or the people they thought represented it. And now you're finding, I think, a whole new interest and active participation of younger women.
But it's not as if your victory translated into a universal victory. One of the first things that President Obama did was the sign the Lilly Ledbetter Act, and that's still a battle before the courts.
Yes, I mean, I always say, like the civil rights movement, the women's movement hasn't solved everything. There's some, you know, women have made enormous progress in all industries and certainly in the media, but yes, there's some really tough problems. One is unfair pay, which this tried to reconcile. There are certainly very few women at the top. The glass ceiling is now at the sort of executive suite, where there continue to be very few women who run companies, including women in the media. There are serious work-family issues that I don't consider a women's issue. I think are a societal issue, but because women are responsible for mostly responsible for the care of their children and their parents, it's now become what is called the leaky pipeline. We thought if you just got women in the pipeline, they would succeed. What happens is many of them don't take bigger responsibilities or higher positions because they can't be both a boss and a good parent. And that's a problem for society, not a women's problem. It's a societal problem.
Well, I recently, Lynn Povich, spoke with Hannah Rosen, who has a new book out, The End of Men and the Rise of Women. And I think one of the main points that she makes is that just out of economic necessity, women are taking a huge part of the workplace and, more importantly, a huge part of the family income and a growing percentage of the family income. And indeed, there are an awful lot of women who hold up the entire family. And as she mentioned in her book, that having a man is just another mouth to feed for a lot of women. So there is, the economic realities of America has changed, but the rights of women have not kept up with the economic realities.
That's correct. And I mean, since Hannah wrote this book, I have to say that women have lost almost around 40% of the gains that they made, because, of course, the jobs that were lost were mostly in manufacturing and the kinds of jobs that men held. So it's not clear to me yet exactly where we're going to end up in terms of how men and women are working in the workforce. And I do think she's right that women have the ability to adapt to the new workforce and have the kinds of skills that are required in service economies, unlike what has been sort of considered male skills of manufacturing and stuff like that. But you have to look at those jobs. I mean, a lot of service jobs are healthcare jobs. They're not particularly high paying. And a lot of high paying jobs like tech jobs, which are growing, there are not that enough women in those jobs.
So, again, I'm speaking with Lynn Povich, the author of the new book, The Good Girls Revolt, How the Women of Newsweek Sued Their Bosses and Changed the Workplace. So let's look at the landscape of reporters now, the ones that we see on television. And several of them are in the most high-profile positions, for example, 60 Minutes, which is still the big ratings news program that there is. You've got Lara Logan out there being a war correspondent. You had recently had Marie Colvin killed in Syria. Mm-hmm. I guess Christiane Amanpour created a kind of model, if you will, for the female war correspondent or foreign correspondent. So, how would you? Can you draw a line from what you all did at Newsweek in suing to where we are today?
Well, our suit was the first women in the media to sue. And after us, Time Inc. sued for Time Inc., Fortune, and Sports Illustrated. The New York Times sued. The Reader's Digest sued. NBC sued. So we kind of opened the doors for all of these lawsuits in the media. And there was enormous progress between 75 and 85 in all industries. Women just flooded into the workforce. And I think what you're seeing today is the beneficiaries of that, the fact that we had a woman on staff who was not sent to Vietnam. They would not send a woman to Vietnam, but she was later sent to Somalia. And women were not sent to cover wars. I mean, Gloria Emerson was very famously sent by the New York Times, but she was one of very few. I don't know about in Europe or the BBC, but in America, very few women covered that war. Now, as you're right, you turn on television, women are covering Iraq and they're covering Syria and they're Arab speakers and they're covering the president. They're not just covering the first lady. So there has been enormous progress for women in the media. They're in senior management. They're just not at the top. I mean, the New York Times, for the first time last year, has a woman editor of the New York Times. Tina Brown is now the editor of Newsweek, editor-in-chief of Newsweek. But most of the network news stations have never had a woman head of it. The cable news stations don't have a woman head of it. I mean, NPR has been better. It has in the past. But, you know, I think that that's an issue because you can get so far. You can be a reporter. You can be a star reporter. You can even be an anchor. We had, two women anchors at the same time. But in terms of who's calling the shots, it's a different story.
But of course, in your story of how you and the women at Newsweek sued to get recognition and to break in to the glass ceiling and eventually move from being researchers and secretaries to becoming journalists, your boss was a woman, Kay Graham.
Kay Graham.
And she wasn't a sister, according to your book.
Catherine Graham, when we sued in 1970, had recently stepped in to run the company after her husband died in 1963. And she was, if you've read her marvelous autobiography, very insecure about her position there and the fact that she was now running this company. And she was quoted at the time as saying, I think a man could be better in this job than I am. So when we sued, the editor of Newsweek, Osborne Elliott, called her to explain that the women at Newsweek had sued the magazine. And her famous response was, which side am I supposed to be on? So on the one hand, she was a boss. She was the boss of the company. On the other hand, as one of the few women who actually owned and ran a media company, she herself was often the only woman in the room, discriminated against, not allowed in the gridiron club. So this torn, this sort of confusion in her mind, I think was very true for many women at the time of trying to make this transition. And she credits Gloria Steinem in her book as saying that it was thanks to Gloria that she finally began to understand what the women's movement was all about.
You mean Gloria sat down with her and explained it?
She met Gloria and asked Gloria to explain feminism to her. And Gloria said to me, it's quoted in the book as saying, you know, I sat down and I sort of did Feminism 101, and she invited me to go to a lunch with Stuart Alsop because she wanted me to explain to him what feminism was about. As she sat there herself listening to Gloria do it, as if she couldn't really do it herself.
Well, we're grateful to be able to have your book and for your sharing your experiences with us today.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Ian. It's my pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Lynn Purvich, who began a career at Newsweek as a secretary, and in 1975 she became the first woman senior editor in the magazine's history. Since leaving Newsweek, she's been editor-in-chief of Working Women magazine and managing editor, senior executive producer for MSNBC.com. She's the author of the new book, The Good Girls Revolt, How the Women of Newsweek Sued Their Bosses and Changed the Workplace. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for streaming and podcasting at ianmasters.com, where we welcome your comments. And the conversation continues online at facebook.com/ianmastersmedia. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.
Time.